This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 2nd of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. Today I'm joined in the studio by Dominic Maxwell, theatre critic for The Times, who is armed with information on a trio of productions worthy of your attention this month. We'll be talking about the 50th anniversary revival of Harold Pinter's play The Homecoming, Evening at the Talkhouse at the Dorfman Theatre, and finally the world's best-selling touring magic show, The Illusionists. Just some of the tricks coming up right here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Well, welcome to the show, Dominic. Let's start with the 50th anniversary revival of The Homecoming. This is Harold Pinter's sinister play taking place inside a claustrophobic and brutal household. Dominic, the blurb here almost recalls the simmering tense style of Tennessee Williams. And of course, it was first performed in the mid-60s, back when Williams' work was all over cinema screens. What did you make of it? Are there similarities here?
Blimey, you've never seen Tennessee Williams quite like this. In fact, you've never really seen Harold Pinter quite like this. I mean, the thing about Pinter is, as you say, sinister is a great word for it, claustrophobic. It's really weird. It's a really weird play. It's one of those plays, if anyone tells you they understand everything about it, they're lying. It doesn't entirely add up, but in a good way. and in a way that makes it always satisfying or always interesting to see. Yes, this one is a wacky production. It's kind of half Hammer horror, half kitchen sink. Jamie Lloyd is always a sort of a big showman in his productions, and he's really laid on the sort of psychedelic effects here.
That's interesting. Because I'm just reading the synopsis here. So we've got Teddy returning home from America to introduce his wife Ruth to the family in London, but they discover a quite brutal household where his father Max, brothers Lenny and Joey, and Uncle Sam live in a state of mutual loathing and festering resentment. But you say that it's actually quite stylistic. So, taking from that, I'm imagining some sort of family drama, perhaps in the style of August Osage County.
Yeah, and it is that, and it can be played like that. I have seen it played like that. It goes weird, though. Well, two things. A, it's sort of more concentrated. In its power play, it's so concentrated that it sort of goes beyond realism anyway. But you can play that very straight. What they do here is zero in on that. There's smoke, there's sound effects, there's people sort of suddenly appearing upstage. You know, when John Sim first appears, it's almost like John Pertwee's Doctor Who sort of hoving into view because of the way that the set is laid out and the way the backdrop looks. There are points at which you think, oh, blimey, is this going to overwhelm the play? Is this something we should be finding this out for ourselves from the play? But actually, as it goes on, it gets more and more comfortable, this, and it's also very funny.
So it sort of verges onto that style overbearing the substance, but doesn't quite push it too far.
It's so well done. I mean, and what really matters, you can do all this stuff and it doesn't really matter if the performances aren't there in the middle. There are some cracking performances here. There is Ron Cook as the sort of splenetic patriarch, emasculating his boys, being just horrible to his daughter-in-law, who he hasn't met before. There is John Sim in it with a kind of music hall, as a kind of music hall psychopath, as his middle son, Lenny. There's Gary Kemp as a sort of academic, not quite like any academic you've ever come across before. And at first you think, oh, no, it's just because Kemp doesn't act very much. But then you think, actually, no, there is something deliberately odd about this. And it all comes together, I think.
Now, I think that can really speak to the genius of writing when you can have a play like this 50 years after it was first performed, and it still feels relevant. It still feels like you're taking something contemporary from what you're seeing here. And, I mean, I mentioned Tennessee Williams before, and you certainly get that from a lot of his works as well. When you're watching this, how do you feel? Does it feel like something that could take place now, that could be relevant to now?
Well, like I say, it's two in one. It's both, yes, family. It's a family dynamic that could happen now. It's the particular class structure and whatever is very much of its time. But it kind of goes into, and forgive me, the mythic, I think we'll call it, is, without announcing itself as that, the daughter-in-law, played by Gemma Chan, in a very peculiar sort of doll-like blank manner, comes across and she gets abused and sort of not literally spat at, but sidled up to by all the characters. But at the end, she goes to live with them to be their mother and perhaps their prostitute. And you can look at it as her subjugation, or you can look at it as her triumphing over them, or her power over them. And I think in this production particularly, you think the latter. But there are no absolute answers. Like I say, if you come to any one explanation of this play, you're wrong.
That is The Homecoming, which is playing at Trafalgar Studios until the 13th of February. Let's move on now, Dominic, to Evening at the Talkhouse, which is a new play from someone who's likely quite familiar to most people as a supporting actor and guest star across all manner of TV and film. Give us some background. This is from Wallace Shawn. It's his new stage production, Evening at the Talkhouse. Perhaps just give us some background on what the play actually is first.
Yeah, that's a challenge as well. This is, if anything, even odder. Wallace Shawn, as you say, he's the baddie in The Princess Bride. He's the purple dinosaur in the Toy Story films. He also does these wonderfully abstruse and uncomfortable, and at their best, simply wonderful plays. One of them became the film My Dinner with Andre. And there's one which is actually one of the favourites, my favourite things I've seen this year, which is The Fever, which was done by the Alameda in a hotel in the middle of town. And in that, he contrasted the sort of plush surroundings and the comfort of his well-off liberal audience with the sort of third world poverty of the events that were being described. Now, here he does something that it is quite a challenge to just say exactly what it is. This is I called it a dystopian backstage drama.
Right, quite a combination there. It's quite a cocktail of themes.
Yeah, it's sort of Jeffrey Bernard is Unwell meets The Hunger Games, but not like either of those. Okay, how can I very quickly explain it? It is set in a sort of members club, the kind of thing you might find in Soho. Whether it's the New York Soho or the London Soho, we can't quite be sure because the cast are both English and American. They are reuniting 10 years after a sort of fringe success they had. And for the first 40 minutes, Ian Rickson's production plays like a slightly odd, quite amusing sort of reunion drama. And then at that point, we find out that the society they're living in not only dislikes theatre, it also lays a sort of onus on the citizens to do something called targeting, which means sounding like everyone has to go and sort of launch their own drone strikes in private as a kind of civil duty on enemies of the state. And that is presented as the price of peace. Now, if this is quite hard to get a handle on listening to it, it's quite hard to get a handle on watching it.
Just going by some of the reviews, it is interesting when you have something like this and you can't really get a consensus on what everyone seems to think.
Yeah.
Everyone seems to be coming out of this particular play with something different on their mind. So it's an assortment of characters all caught in one place where the drama starts to unfold. Mm. And I've heard one critic at least describe it as basically Wallace Shawn telling us that we're all heading towards a culture of consciousness-stifling escapism.
Oh, I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I tell you what it feels like to watch. It feels like a sort of art house version of an Agatha Christie thriller. I love Wallace Shawn. I love what he's getting at here. I love the way he mixes that sort of very queasy social satire with that very comfortable setting. The brothers Quick Key have done this very gloomily grand set. It's wonderful to look at. I love the idea of it. I just think, boldly, it needed another draft or two because there's a lot of moments where people just stand around listening to each other talk. There are lots of moments when sort of very unlikely things happen and people just look at each other and listen. And it just, even as it was going, there were moments when I was thinking, yay, this is so weird, I like it. And then there'll be moments where I go, yeah, but oh, come on, just get to the point. It's a real challenge.
Do you think there's a bit of a problem here when sometimes you've got people who have clearly worked on these sorts of works and they become pet projects and they turn into these... Well, there's an old saying when you're learning to write a screenplay, you have to get to the point where you kill your baby. Mm. You know, you have to look at something that you've nurtured for a long time and then tear it to pieces and find out everything that's wrong with it. And sometimes I think people can skip that. And I know that there are other people who, like Wallace Shawn, have worked as actors. Robert Redford is one that springs to mind. A lot of pet projects over the years, but every now and then you get something like Lions for Lambs and you look at it and think, that needed a little bit more workshopping.
It's a really tough balance, isn't it? because he's not going for something formulaic. He's going for something that isn't going to be like anything you've quite seen before. And on the one hand, I don't, you know, you don't want to say, oh, no, do it like everyone else does it. That's not the point at all. But I do think, and this is its world premiere, I do think someone probably needs to say, I love it. I love it. I want you to put it in a drawer for a month and come back and think how we can bring out all the strengths here, because I think we, the audience, are sort of almost going with him as he tries to figure out what it's all about.
Fascinating, rambling, perhaps slightly incomprehensible. That is Evening at the Talkhouse, which is playing at the Dorfman Theatre until the 30th of March. Now, finally, off to the Illusionists. And it seems to me that magic shows can go in one of two directions. So you've got the Las Vegas-style garish excessiveness, or the slightly musty old pull a coin out of an ear type of affair. But this one has become the world's best-selling magic show. Dominic, what is the secret?
It's kind of a Pret-a-Manger approach. It's very, very good at what it does. It's not that none of them are the most distinctive acts you've seen, but I sat there with a big grin on my face all evening. I think there's seven acts, there's six regulars, and there's one guest star, which is Jamie Raven from Britain's Got Talent. And the real key to it is it's so quick. Even Derren Brown, who is fantastic, who's an amazing showman, even Derren Brown spends a lot of his shows getting in and out of the tricks. This one, because they have a high turnover of acts, nothing lasts more than about 5 minutes. And so it just keeps you going. It is cheesy. It is Vegas-y at points. There is a sort of pomp rock band that sounds a bit like, I don't know, Toto or Asia or something, clinking away in the background. You know, I don't think it's particularly pretending to be cutting edge. It's comparing itself to Cirque du Soleil. And so it's got that kind of sense of spectacle, but it's just got a pace about it.
Okay, so it's quite snappy, but I have heard a few people say that it takes itself a little bit too seriously. Now, I've always been a big fan of the classic TV show Bewitched, which, thanks to my grandfather, introduced me to all kinds of magic trickery via the television. But I do think that magic, above all other things, does have to be fun. Does it feel like fun?
Yeah, I read those reviews as well. I found it fabulous fun. There is one outright comic magician, which normally your heart sinks at, the sort of funny uncle magician.
My heart just sank when you said
that. Yeah, yeah. He's particularly good with the kids. My two children were there, and they particularly loved him. But actually, I did too. He was wonderful. What you're not going to get is the kind of overt smarts that you get from something like Derren Brown or Penn and Teller. You don't get that sort of, yeah, we all know what this is about, and aren't we clever for enjoying it? And I don't mean that to knock them. They're fantastic. This is, in a way, a vanilla magic show, but it's the sort of 21st century evolution of it. As I say, there are still assistants in glamorous assistants in costumes, and it would be nice if there were some female magicians as well to join this roster. They say that it's very hard to get top level female magicians.
Yes, but you always seem to see them off to the side in those sparkly dresses. Yeah. Pulling those people apart. It does almost feel as though you're watching a 1950s game show at some point, don't you think?
I guess it feels like you're watching a 2015 game show. I would argue that for it. And there are some really genuinely great. There's a guy who got cut in half and then kept moving in this. I have no. You know, a lot of them. You think, well, I kind of know how that one's done, or I don't exactly know, but I've got this one. We were going, how on earth was that done? And there are a few moments like there's a guy who holds his breath upside down underwater, getting out of his chains for 3 minutes. Just someone holding his breath for 3 minutes. I'll give them a round of applause.
That is agonizing. I am always terribly frightened when I see people holding their breath underwater, because you do, every now and then you do hear about those people that actually come very close to drowning. And I always think, please don't let that happen.
And I think there's that sequence in Mission Impossible 5 when they all go underwater, and I could hardly breathe watching that after a while. And it was a bit like this here. You suddenly think, get a move on.
Well, indeed, the magic is at least impressive then. That is The Illusionists, which is playing at the Shaftesbury Theatre until the 3rd of January. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Dominic Maxwell, thank you very much for joining us as always. You have, of course, been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. My producer today was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when Mark Mason will be in the studio for our weekly book review. But for now, thanks very much for listening.